This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Rachel Johns, welcome back to Better Reading.
Thank you, Cheryl. I love speaking to you.
Yeah, it's really nice, isn't it? And also, you're kind of a friend to us, to the team, because we all love you and we've known you for such a long time. But you're also a friend to our readers.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, a lot of your readers are also, I mean, you've got hundreds of thousands of readers and stuff now, aren't you? So if only I was friends with all of them, that would be great.
I think they have a relationship with you, and anytime we do a post or we talk about you, people know you and they will come up with a book and they'll talk about it. And, you know, I mean, I guess you've been around a long time. We've been around now 8 years and you've been part of that growth for us.
Yeah. I think like probably because I've been around about 12 years, so yeah. I've been around a lot. We've both been around longer than that, right, Cheryl? But I remember doing a couple of things really early on in your office. One live, I think, with two other women, and I'm not going to say their names in case I get it wrong now. But yeah, so I've been, you know, seeing the growth of Better Reading, and I guess you've been following the growth of me. But
it's
I have a online presence, and I interact with the readers through that, and we have an online book club. So, you know, like you have lots of opportunities to talk to people.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a great thing to be able to connect with readers just right there. I mean, you often join in on our What Are You Reading on a Thursday.
Yeah, when I should be writing.
Thursday at 2 o'clock. But isn't it great, the spontaneity of it? It's fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there's so many good things about social media, aren't they? And that is one of them, the community and the connection that we can get with people that we never would have really had anything to do with previously. Of course, there's lots of negative things too. And I think it's a balance, you know, you've got to work really hard to keep that balance, to maintain your own mental health in those spaces, because, you know, majority of readers are wonderful. I love you all. But occasionally, because you're so accessible, you can get, you know, accessed by someone who's not so lovely. And, you know, you've got to really protect yourself in those cases, I think. Yeah. Mm.
I mean, I often say to people, because, you know, particularly here in San Francisco, a lot of my friends aren't even on social media. They don't like it. It's a big it's a big black mark. And, you know, they only read mastheads and whatever, which is great. But the thing is, I say to them, you do miss out on something. And I feel
you do something.
Yeah, I feel our book community, and yours is probably the same, you know, like, I don't know, we're up to 380,000, right?
It's amazing.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yet I feel all the time, very, maybe 99.9% of the time, it's all love and empathy and a passion for reading and everything else. Very, very occasionally, honestly, I could probably count them on one hand how many negative comments we've had over 10 years, you know. So it's largely what Facebook is for, is to share like interests, to share what you're reading. And I often say to people, Better Reading is an example of what Facebook should be.
Yes, I completely agree, because I think, you know, there is the opportunity, as I said, to connect with people who you haven't. And I think in the book world especially, you know, you may not know many readers necessarily in your own world, or you might have friends who read different things, and the opportunity, I mean, yeah, any hobbies, I suppose, the opportunity to connect with people you previously wouldn't have. I'm sure it's happened in your group, but in our online book club, people have met in real life afterwards, and they've connected and created their own little, you know, offshoot groups. And I think that is truly amazing. Saying that though, I don't blame your friends. Like, I am very much, I'm on social media because I enjoy interacting with readers, but I am on it for work because of that. I always feel guilty because I don't actually really post on my own private Facebook page, or but that's probably because I don't have the time. But yeah, so I don't know. Sometimes I think if I didn't have to do it for work, I mean, I don't have to, but you know what I mean? Like, then I don't know if I think I would sometimes want a little bit of a detox from it because, you know, we are so online these days. But, yeah, there's good things and bad things.
All right. Now, Rachel is one of the hardest working authors in the business, and I know that. You don't just write. You connect with your readers. But, you know, there's something else that I really like about what you do is that you connect and empower other writers.
Well, that's really lovely. Well, I think I've been around a long time, as we've said, because even though I've been published for 12 years, I've been in the writing world since I was 17, which is, you know, 25 years or so ago now, over, I just realised maths. And, you know, in that time I've met a lot of people, but I've also been helped by a lot of people myself, especially in the world of sort of romance and women's fiction. You know, when I was an aspiring writer and, you know, looking for direction from people who had gone before or advice and, you know, wisdom, people were there and they, so I feel like it's just part of, you know, giving back to what was given to me.
Yeah. Well, you certainly do that. She has not only written bestsellers such as The Work Wives, Flying the Nest, and her ABIA award-winning book, The Patterson Girls, but she also loves her readers, as we've just said, regularly talking to them online with her online book clubs. And that's another thing too that we haven't mentioned is that you do so many live events around the country. You do quite a bit of travelling, don't you?
Yeah, I have, obviously post-COVID, and it's great to be able to actually connect with the people, you know, face-to-face. It is tiring. I don't know how Taylor Swift does it because she's like, you know, I have to just talk for half an hour or an hour, and, you know, and I have to dance and sing and every day. But it is tiring, but it's also really exciting. But I guess, like, I think the more you do, like, people are like, oh, well, you didn't go here, you know, you didn't go to Canberra, you didn't go. And in the end, that's a small part of my job, really. I mean, my main job is supposed to be to write books, you know, and so you've got to protect that writing time as well, because it's very easy to be doing events, and especially there's so many wonderful festivals around the country, and, you know, libraries are always asking for people. It's very, you know, that could be a full-time job in itself. So I'm trying to go hard for short, you know, small times, and then get back into my writing cave.
And you're good at it because I've done a few events with you and I think it suits your personality. But there are a lot of people who find that challenging, you know, that a lot of writers. So. Yeah, that's not their gig.
Like, as we said, I get quite exhausted by it. But you said, like, I'm probably, I always forget, am I an extrovert, an introvert, or an introvert, extrovert? I don't know. But I also have a drama degree, and public speaking is something that I quite enjoy. So, yeah, it's hard for me in that it's tiring. So I can only imagine for the people who really it's out of their comfort zone, they get nervous. You know, I think when you decide to write a book, you are not thinking about, you know, most people when they decide I'm going to write a book, they're thinking about one particular story, getting it out there, maybe having the book on shelf. You don't think about all the other stuff that comes with the business of being an author. And, yeah, part of that is doing things like this. Part of it is doing events. There's also like online promotion, socials and stuff. There's updating a website. There's accounting. I'm very bad at that. Mm. You know, so you don't really think about all the other things, I think, that come with a job as being an author. And, yes, no one's going to love all of that, are they? So
No.
Everyone's good at different things.
Absolutely. I always say that. Can't be good at everything. So Rachel's here to talk to us about her new book. It's called The Other Bridget. And it's a really lovely, uplifting book, and it's about books. It's about the celebration and power and pleasure of romance novels through the ages. And it's a little bit different to your others, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say it sort of sits a little bit in the middle probably. So previously I started in rural romance, which is kind of self-explanatory, romance novels in small towns. And then I wrote The Patterson Girls, which sort of launched me into another area, which is more, I always say relationship fiction, but all my stories are relationship fiction. The romance is obviously love story, people falling in love. The relationship, so the women's fiction is more like the other relationships we have in our lives, you know, the ones with friends, family, sometimes multi-generational, sometimes work colleagues, occasionally strangers. I really just love the dynamics of complex relationships and stuff. But this book, I guess, is a little bit in between both of those. I actually saying it's kind of half a romance, and it ticks the boxes for a romance that, you know, you follow a love story from people meeting and, you know, the complications, and then happy for now, at least. There is a love triangle, though, so it's not 100% straightforward. But I think the other half of the book is the other relationships you have in your life, is your friendships. And in this particular case, it's also, for me, a love letter to books and librarians. So that is almost as strong. It's being marketed as a rom-com. That makes me worry slightly because I'm like, is it funny enough? But people have said they've laughed and cried. So, yeah, it's kind of, and this is my first book with just one person, like, oh, and I had another one a few years ago, but it's a different sort of vibe. It's first person present tense, which I used to hate reading, first person present tense. So to have written a book in first person present tense is a big turn. But, yeah, so it's kind of just got a little bit of a different vibe. It's a little bit more romantic comedy, I suppose, than any of my others. Yeah.
And can we talk about one of the characters in the book that is familiar
sure.
to me? And to
I'm guessing you? I know he's are we talking about John Brown?
We are talking about John Brown. He makes an appearance in the early part of the book. Thank you for that. Now, was he based on my dog? Everybody
well,
keeps
I knew
asking.
You had a dog, I knew you had a dog called John Brown because I remember you told either you told me anything or I've seen you talk online, yeah. you know, probably multiple yeah. things. And one of my favourite books from childhood and still one of my favourite books is
Absolutely.
John Brown Wrote and the Midnight Cat. And actually, so the John Brown in that book was an old English sheepdog, right? And I, ever since I was little and reading that book, I wanted an old English sheepdog. So I got an old English sheepdog when I was about 24. I didn't call him John Brown. I don't know why. I called him Roger. But
I like
because
that.
This book is a book about books
yeah.
And every – one of the love interests is called Fabio, which is kind yeah. of a bit of a homage, you know, to the, yeah. the cover model. Yeah. We've got obviously the other Bridget, which is she's named after Bridget Jones. So I thought having her dog being named after a fictional dog, and John Brown is, yes, one of my favourite fictional characters. And I did know you had a John Brown, so I thought that was also fun.
Do you know, I love that story.
Your dog. Yeah. Like in terms of, what was your breed of dog?
Oh, he's only a Maltese poodle. He's like a tenth of the size.
Actually, no. So yeah. Well, there's poodle in the John Brown
yes.
book. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, in the original book, he's tiny. But do you know what it is? And I love the original book, like you. I mean, that's where I got the name from. I always have a stack at home, and I gift it to people. And it is, for me, in terms of literature, one of the shortest stories I know, but so powerful and so
heartwarming.
In such few words.
I often used to say to my kids, one of the lines in that, I'm staying in bed all day and forever.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a lovely, beautiful book. And the relationship between the elderly lady and her dog, but then the jealousy of the dog and the cat. You know, there's so many emotions in that
book. And also it's about grief and depression. Yes. I mean, Rose is unhappy, you know. It is really lovely. Before we get off the John Brown topic, and we will, but this is super cute because the fact that he had two first names or a double-barreled first name, as you like, some people could never get their head around it. One of the guys in the park always called him John, assuming that his surname was Brown. Yeah. But I had this beautiful cleaner, this lovely, lovely cleaner called Crystal. Crystal was from Mongolia, and her and I didn't cross paths. She'd come in and clean when I was at work, whatever. But occasionally I would see her. Anyway, I ran into her in the park one day, and she said to me, Cheryl, your dog, he's so beautiful. He's so beautiful. I just love him. He's so gentle. I said, he is. He's really beautiful. She said, what's his name? Now, English is a second language for her, right? So she was speaking with a very thick accent, and she said to me, what's his name? And I said, his name is John Brown. And she said, no, not your husband, your dog.
Because she can't imagine a dog having a first and second.
John Brown. Oh, that's hilarious. That's so funny.
It was very funny. She was very beautiful. So I said, just call him John. So what book number is the other Bridget? What are we up to?
It is the 20th full length in print. But I have had a number of digital novellas as well.
Yeah, wow.
Exactly. It's around 30 if we're counting all them.
Wow. I want to first ask you about the difference in terms of publishing. So you've moved publishers, but for all those people out there, and there's a lot of aspiring writers that listen to this podcast, tell me about the different processes in terms of editorial. Like, you've moved, and does everybody do things the same? Was this a new experience? Talk to me about all of that.
Pretty much the same. So the only difference is, I guess, is in how – So I was with Harper, and I'm still with Harper for one more book, and I'm with Penguin as well. At Harper, my publisher is not my editor, but that's not necessarily the case for everyone. So I have a contracted editor from out of he freelances. I think you know him.
I do know him. Yeah.
I adore him. Yeah. So they sort of work together, the publisher and the contract editor, and he we go through structural edits, which is the big picture stuff, and then the copy edits and then proofreading. Copy edits is more like line by line, making sure everything kind of works on a smaller level. And then obviously proofreading is hopefully catching up all the mistakes. So it's pretty much the same at mm-hmm. Penguin, except there my publisher is my editor. So she does the structural herself. And so she's very much working as I go kind of thing and brainstorming and, you know, talking about things and stuff. And then she has a different copy editor who works in-house. So those the one difference I've found is that Penguin still prints off the page proofs and sends them to you. And I always used to watch other authors getting their page proofs in the post and, you know, having to and that's one thing. I think Harper and Harlequin are obviously better with saving the paper.
Yeah, saving the trees.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm really interested in this myself. Do you think the influence, like if this book, if The Other Bridget had been published by your people at Harper, would it have been a different book?
Oh, that's a good question. I think obviously the book would have been the same probably in terms of, well, obviously my writing the first draft would have been the same, but there's a couple of reasons. Yes, I've never thought about that, but it could be quite different because one, the covers would have been completely different, I think, because, you know, each publisher has their sort of own kind of vision of what they want, you know, the book to look like, and then they take that to the cover department and marketing, and they all have this big discussion. So that could be quite different. But I guess the insides could have been quite different too, because when you submit a book to a publisher, it's a very collaborative experience. I think a lot of people think that I have to then do exactly what they say and that they'll change stuff without me even. No, that's totally not the case. Mm. It's teamwork. You know, I've taken a book as far as I can kind of go, and then it's really great to have someone who's so knowledgeable about the book world to read it from it. You know, they're not so close to it as I am. They can see things that I've sort of thought were there, but they're not. But yeah, it may have been quite different had, say, I have two people reading it and putting a lot of impact in at Harper and then two at Penguin. They're very different people. They're very different about the things that they like to read. They're different in terms of values and just, like, you know, lots of differences. So I do think, I've never really thought about that, but yeah, they would have maybe made me take the edit in a different direction, which I actually did quite a lot of editing on this book. It seemingly was a light edit, but once I got stuck into it, there was a lot of things that I thought, hang on, no, I want to tighten this, I want to change this or whatever. But that could have been quite different if I had got different advice. So, yeah, I never thought about that. But in a different world, maybe there's another Bridget.
That's right. Do you know, I have thought about that over the years, and I've always forgotten to ask authors. So I made a note today. I'm going to ask Rachel that question.
Do you know, I think as well, something I often think about is when I'm sitting down to write, I aim for about 2,000 words a day. I don't always get there. I'm not like some authors who stop exactly. I think Fiona McIntosh stops exactly at the 2,000 mark or whatever, even if she's mid-sentence. I'm not that. I'll do sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. But I'll very much follow my gut in terms of how I'm feeling, if I'm ready to continue or, you know, if I'm, and I sometimes think, oh, if I'd stayed done another hour on a book, it could have gone in quite a different direction. Whereas the next morning I've got, you know, different ideas, something else has happened overnight. And so, yeah, I think books could be, there could be hundreds of different versions of books depending on who edits them, when you're writing them, you know, so many different things.
Many years ago, I had this friend of mine. She decided she wanted to write and she wasn't a writer. And I said, oh, what are you going to write about? She said, oh, well, I can't tell you. And I was like, oh, okay, whatever.
Did she think you were going to see it? Or?
Yeah. And she said, oh, I'm not going to tell you because, you know, I'm not going to tell anyone, not just me. She said, I'm not going to tell anyone because they steal the idea. I thought, all right. And I pondered on that, you know, that afternoon when I was walking John Brown. And I thought, if you gave three authors, if you selected three authors, and you said to them, Rachel, or all three of them, can you please write a story about walking your dog in the afternoon? That'd all be very different
stories. They would be completely different. I do think that's something that a lot of new writers worry about, that if you tell someone your idea or you enter a competition or you ask someone to read it for feedback, that that person might then think, oh, that's a great idea, and take that idea. But I think that's very, I mean, I've never heard, that's very, very unlikely to happen, I think, for a number of reasons. Mostly I have people come up to me at events or email me and they'll say, oh, I've got a great idea for a book. I've got a great idea. I've got a great story. And usually I'm like, oh, great, tell me, because, hey, we're always on the lookout. But invariably their story is interesting to them, their idea. But to me, there's no spark. You need to have, when you get an idea, you need to go, oh my gosh, I'm so excited about that. I have to write that. You know, like you have to feel it. Mm. And so taking someone else's idea, I don't think it would work on so many levels.
Well, and also too, because, you know, we all know that fiction is fiction, but in fiction is a great part of who you are as a writer.
Yes, that's so true. You put yourself in there. So also the thing is there's no new story. So I think one thing that people probably think sometimes is that maybe people are stealing their ideas, but that is so not the case. Mm. I think it's just that the zeitgeist sometimes, like I think it's amazing. A few years ago there were, I think, three gardening novels out. It was one by Fiona Lowe, one by Sophie Green, and there was somebody else, Barbara Hannay, right? They were all like community garden novels. Now I happen to know that none of those authors were talking to each other about, you know, and heard one of them say, it's just there's something out there. And then a year or so later, there was the choirs. There was Meg Bignall's, the Angry Woman's choir. Fiona Lowe did a choir one and someone else did a choir one. And there's also the same with old people's running away from old people's homes. It was the same. There was escape from, you know, and it's just things are out in the zeitgeist. So, and they're all different books, you know, they're not the same book about a choir. So no. I think it's something that people spend too much time worrying about. I actually myself, though, for years, an idea would come up to me and I thought, I can't do that because, you know, someone's already written a book about that or whatever. And I have to now remind myself that that doesn't matter because my idea, I mean, someone's written a book about everything, right? So I can either give up or I can just try and make mine different,
Well, I mean, the reason why people are drawn to writers, and I know this, you know, with you, what they're drawn, they know what they're going to expect in a way.
Yeah.
They know that your storytelling style, they know your mood, they know what they're going to expect in a plot. Now, it's not that it's predictive, but it's your personality.
I know exactly what you mean. And one of my favourite authors is a US author, Ellen Hildebrand. I don't know if you've ever heard or read her. She's written mostly books. She's been published for about 25 years, one book a year mostly, a couple of two. But she's written mostly books set on Nantucket Island, which I really want to go to.
Yes.
And she says that she has to do exactly the same book every year but completely different. And I really like that. I feel if you're writing something like rural romance, say, that's even harder to do that. And so same if you're setting a book in the same place, you know, because you do have to give the readers what they want, the promise of the sort of the genre that they, but at the same time, nobody wants to read the same book over, unless it's a book you love and you're rereading it because it's a comfort read. You don't want to read the same book by the same person over and over again.
Do you think you'd ever venture out into, say, crime or a genre or horror or fantasy? I don't know.
Probably not horror or fantasy. I've got an answer for this because, people have asked this recently and I realised something. So I ventured into, I mean, all my genres, as we said, are quite linked, but like it was not linked, but they're close. Yeah. They're not like fantasy. Yeah. I don't write sci-fi and inspirational romance. But I think because the reason I wrote The Patterson Girls and sort of moved into it was not because I suddenly thought I want to write a women's fiction novel, even though I'd always loved those kind of stories. So that's my first love, books by people like Marion Keyes, Kathy Kelly, Monica McEnany, all those books. But I wasn't thinking, oh, I want to write a book like this. The idea came to me and I could not stop thinking about that idea. It developed from there. And then once I'd written one, you know, if one does write reasonably well, you kind of have permission to continue in that. So I think this is the same with this rom-com, if we're calling this slightly different. It wasn't that I said, oh, rom-coms seem to be going well, like, you know, that's what everyone's reading or whatever. It was simply that I got an idea about a librarian named after famous Bridget Jones, and I had to follow the idea. And it was sort of because of the story was named, was sort of pays homage to the original Bridget Jones, which is kind of a rom-com, then this automatically became that. So I think, I mean, I love reading crime. I especially love like mystery, sort of more than psychological thriller. I really love books with ghosts. I have written a few, but, you know, like so a little more supernatural. But I think the answer is if the idea comes, then I would give it a shot. But I wouldn't feel like, oh, I want to write a crime, so let's come up and think of what the crime story is, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, no, I get it totally. I want to ask you a final question because we're running out of time. I often think about you and your career because when, you know, 20 books, when you started writing, your life was very, very different to what it is now, right? And the transition and growing up and raising your children and working. And now you told me before we hit record that you and your husband are going on a holiday because you're almost empty nesters. How has that, do you think, affected your work? Firstly, in a practical way, the way you write, like the way you approach your day, has that changed? And then your writing.
So the practical, definitely, because I started when I was 17, had no kids and, you know, was just going into uni and, you know, so basically then I had all the time in the world to write whenever I felt like writing, you know, and then I wasn't published then, I should say, and then I had kids and still was not published, but I had three sort of under four at one stage and I was pretty much, I was stay-at-home mum. I worked occasionally in the local library and occasionally relief teaching, but that was my main job. And I used to write then, if I could manage to get them all to sort of rest and sleep at the same time in the afternoon, that's when I would do it. And I'd also write in the evenings. Now I'm too tired to write in the evenings, but I used to make them go to bed early so I could do that. And, you know, my husband would watch TV or whatever and I'd be next to him writing. So I, for many years, I just fitted around everything else and you have to make time in those years, I think, because it's not just going to be, it's not easy to find the time. So you have to ask for help too. Like my husband was very supportive, luckily. So he would take the kids on the weekend for an hour or so and I'd write and then we'd swap and I'd let him have, you know, a bit of time. But yeah, now that it is my full-time job, I very much treat it like a full-time job and pretty much school hours, but I'm always, I mean, like you know, no one's completely switched off their job, I think, these days. So I will do like social media and stuff outside of those hours. I write primarily in the morning and get my words down. So, yeah, like it's become from a hobby and a passion to something I still love, but it's much more disciplined and it's my job, so I have to do it.
And it's your career. It's your income.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I can't just go, oh, you know, I don't feel like doing it for a few weeks because then I won't get paid. In terms of has my writing or changed it, have I grown up? I mean, it's over half my life that I have been writing. So I think it's a huge, massive part of my life. Someone actually asked me the other day, you know, how do you think your writing has impacted your life? And it's a similar question to you, I guess, in that there's three ways. It's introduced me, it's my job, so it's given me financial, you know, aspect, but it has introduced me to so many people that I would never have met with different life stories, different values, different, you know, cultural backgrounds. So it's opened me up to a whole load more people than I would have necessarily met. And it has also made me think about things. I think that one of the best things about reading is that, you know, we read about people with different views. We read about things we haven't experienced. We can read about places we haven't been, you know, and through that we develop sort of empathy and learn that everyone's different. And we got to, you know, I think become readers are often more accepting of different people or different ideas. And I have definitely, in writing about certain issues throughout my career, I have changed my views on things. I have widened my sort of worldview. And so I think that's hope. And then that's probably reflected in my writing as well. Hope that answers the question.
It does. And I kind of totally agree with that. Like, you know, because all of us change. I mean, what I believed in now, it isn't necessarily what I believed in when I was 18 or 19.
No,
and only not. Because you learn and you grow. But yes, I think too that happens with writers. I often pick it up in the writing. It gets more mature. Even if you're writing similar genres as you were back then, it's still different.
It'd be interesting to do some sort of PhD on a writer who had been writing, you know, their whole adult life kind of thing, and see the progression of their, not only their writing skills and stuff, because you hope that that will get better with practice, but also, on the ideas and the types of things that they, I mean, I think we see that in, you know, one of my favourite authors is Marion Keyes, and I'm lucky enough to be reading her new book, My Favourite Mistake, which is out, I think, in April. And it is like 20 years on from a character that she wrote about. And you can definitely see, obviously, time, the world has changed, but you can see that the issues that Marion Keyes is writing about now are more like kind of the issues that people her age and stuff, you know, are dealing with. Whereas when she was writing a book 25 years ago, they were the issues that younger people were dealing with. So you do, of course, that's going to change as you go along. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. All right, Rachel, we're out of time. We'll let you go.
Thank you so much.
Really nice chatting with you, as always.
Yeah, you too.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBookstore. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.